This is the Dope Farm Podcast. Welcome back to the Dope Farm Podcast. This is Wynn, and I'm your host. Let's jump right in to George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. We're up to rule number 5. Rule number 5 states, if you cough, sneeze, sigh, or yawn, do it not loud, but privately, and speak not in your yawning, but your handkerchief or your hand before your face and turn aside. So this is, this is just common decency. If you have to cough, sneeze, or sigh, you don't do it just out in the open. Have a little common decency for the people that are around you. You need to, again, it all goes back to situational awareness. Knowing who you're around and where you're at, and just be courteous of other people. And I think that's one of the main things that all of these really strike upon, is just being a decent person, being mindful of the people around you. Again, I'll reiterate it. I don't know how many times I'll have to reiterate the fact that that's just something that we lack in this day and age of the me culture, I'm the most important thing in the world. And, we all fall into that from time to time. The only thing I would probably change in that is when they say cough into your hand or yawning in your hand, nowadays, common practice is to cough in your arm, in the crook of your arm, just so you're not spreading germs to your hand. Back in the day, they didn't really understand germs like we do now. So it's just a good rule to live by. So this week's weed of the week is not an edible plant, but something that we really need to be aware of for people in the preparedness community who are out and about in the woods. We might be out foraging, looking for food, or tracking animals, or anything of that nature. And so what I'm going to talk about is poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac. They're distinctly different plants in the way they look. Poison ivy and poison oak both have 3 leaves. Poison ivy has a more rounded, somewhat jagged leaf, but it's very symmetrical, where poison oak is more of a oak-like leaf. So it's got a little bit more detail to it. Now, poison sumac grows on a stem with opposing leaves. So I'm going to read an article here on a website called the Ingledow Group. You can find a link to the page in the show notes at thedopefarmpodcast.com. Facts about poison ivy. Poison ivy grows in the woods, fields, and along roadsides and riverbeds. It can be high-climbing woody vine, a small low-growing shrub, or ground cover. Poison ivy grows in every region of the United States except the Southwest, Hawaii, and Alaska. The following provides information on poison ivy identification, prevention, treatment, and more. Distinguishing characteristics. Leaves of 3, let them be. 3 thin, pointy, shiny leaves. However, the shape, texture, and color of the leaves can vary. leaves are reddish in the spring, green in the summer, orange, red, or bronze in the fall. Toxicity. Most people are sensitive to the oily resin or sap of the poison ivy, urushiol. Urushiol is found year-round in all parts of the plant, including the roots, stems, flowers, and leaves. Animals are not sensitive to poison ivy, but people can get poison ivy from the animal's hair or fur. Potential exposure. Exposures are more common in the spring and the summer. A person can get a rash by touching any part of the poison ivy plant or anything that has come in contact with poison ivy and still has the oily resin on it. Examples include sporting or camping equipment, gardening tools, shoes, clothes, pets, and other contaminated surfaces. Contact with fluid-filled blisters that develop does not spread poison ivy. Smoke from burning poison ivy can cause irritation to the eyes, skin, nose, and difficulty breathing. This irritation can sometimes be severe. A rash may develop between 1 hour and 5 days after contact. The rash can vary in severity and usually starts with itching, redness, and swelling, sometimes followed by tiny pimples or blisters. Delayed symptoms may appear if the skin comes in contact with contaminated items or surfaces. Treatment. Immediately after exposure, within 10 or 15 minutes, wash exposed areas with cool water and soap. Wash contaminated surfaces with rubbing alcohol. Wash clothes and shoes with hot water and soap. See your healthcare provider if symptoms are severe or persist after home treatment. If you experience difficulty breathing, swelling in the throat, or dizziness, weakness, call 911. Prevention. Learn to recognize poison ivy and avoid exposure. Always wear vinyl gloves when removing plants. Urushiol can penetrate rubber. Wear long pants, long sleeves, socks, closed shoes, and a hat when walking in areas with poison ivy. Do not burn poison ivy. So, a little kind of comical story from my past. I used to live with an aunt while I was going to college in Greenville, North Carolina, and the yard was in very, very poor repair, I guess you could say, or it was not very well taken care of. And this was my grandparents' former home, and there was English ivy everywhere. The stuff was taking over. And so I decided I was going to try to clean some of it up. Well, I started stripping the English ivy off the trees, and lo and behold, there was some poison ivy mixed in that you couldn't really see it. But I was wearing short sleeve shirt, just grabbing big bundles of this mess and hauling it into the woods. And my forearms were completely wrapped up with blisters. I mean, from my wrists all the way past my elbow, my forearms basically doubled in size, and I had this just severe allergic reaction to the to this urushiol oil. I had no idea. You know, I had never had a severe case of poison ivy up to this point in my life. My aunt, she was a nurse, and so she knew some doctors and was able to make a phone call. And I ended up having to take a oral steroid for some time to help, you know, help fight that reaction. It was pretty bad. I mean, I was covering myself with calamine lotion, just trying to do anything to kind of quell the itching, but there was very little I could do, honestly. It was just something you had to endure, And I mean, I was blistered and I was going to college, trying to go out, date, this, that, and the other thing. It was a big deal. And so, from that point forward, I pretty much made the decision that if I'm working outside, no matter what the heat, no matter what I'm doing, I'm wearing long sleeves, gloves, pants, shoes, boots, whatever. I don't do a whole lot outside these days. So there's a lot of good information out there about poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac. The best thing to do is just become familiar with them. Get some visual, go to the webpage and look and go and do the research and find out what this stuff looks like. You really need to know. If you're going to be outside for any amount of time, you really need to know what poison ivy looks like. This stuff is no joke. Now, they went into a little bit of treatment, but on the webpage for this show, for this episode, I put a link or I embedded a video from YouTube from a gentleman who says he's been studying this for a long time. And he says, basically, if you know that you've been exposed and you go in and use a washcloth or something to that effect with some soap and water and just go ahead and scrub, it's the scrubbing motion, the scrubbing action that will actually remove the oil. And if you go ahead and get it off, you probably won't even get a rash. You might have some, but you really limit the exposure. And so it doesn't have time to penetrate the skin and cause the reaction. So it's a very good video to watch and just be mindful of that. So let's move on into the main topic of this episode, and that is going to be water. Water, water, water. Water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. And I'm going to tell you, it's one of the most important things, in my opinion, when it comes to survival or preparedness. There are lots of different things that you can do for water procurement. There's lots of sources for water. But you need to be prepared. And this is kind of building on the hurricane preparedness episode I just did. Because water is probably one of the most important things in a survival situation, probably only second to shelter. If you're lost in the woods and it's, you know, freezing cold outside and the wind's blowing, it's raining or whatever, you can die relatively quickly from exposure. But water, like I stated previously, is that you can only survive 3 days without any kind of water. So if you're unable to drink water, you're going to die a horrible death of dehydration, and nobody wants that. So what are the best ways to procure water? Well, for someone that has their own home or lives in an environment in which you can buy water, or you have a county water system, you have options in the sense that you can have, say, water collection or water storage. There are items like water bricks that you can purchase, and they're stackable. Water bricks are 3.5 gallon containers that you can stack on top of each other. And so if you have a garage or a closet or under a bed or anything of that nature, you could take these things and store them fairly easy. So you can, like I say, you can buy them in packages of 8. And, I mean, that's a lot of water. And so that's one method. you can buy water. I mean, gallon of water, drinking water at the grocery store, our local grocery store, Food Line, is, I think it's like 88 cents a gallon. Unfortunately, our local Food Line, the water comes in basically looks like a milk jug. And they're not great for long-term storage because those containers are designed to deteriorate fairly rapidly. I mean, they'll hold water for months, but maybe even a couple of years. But they're designed, they're not UV stable. They won't last very long. You got to keep them up off the floor. Water doesn't ever really go bad, but it will absorb flavors. So if you have water sitting on a floor, it can absorb anything. So if you spill gas, fumes, or anything like that, it will permeate those containers and you'll get a bad taste in the water. So what are some of the methods of collection? So back in the day, before county and city waters and deep water wells, a lot of people had cisterns on their houses, and they basically just routed water with gutters down into the, or not even necessarily gutters back then, but they would have had a V part of a roof where the water would run down and collect in a valley of a roof and run down and maybe just go down into a chute or maybe a gutter, and it would run into a container that was buried either under the house or out in the yard. I know someone who had one in their old house, and it was under the kitchen, and you would have just basically a well pump that you would, go up and down, and it would draw the water into the sink or your vessel or whatever you're going to use it for. So cisterns, you could create a rain catchment system, with using modern materials, plastic barrels, drums. There's a lot of DIY systems out there that if you go online, I mean, there's tens of thousands of them probably. So I'm not going to get too deep into that, but that would be a good method. And on a side note, I've actually thought about trying to set up a cistern system here at my home, or a water collection system here at my home, and tying it into the toilets, so that when you flush a toilet, it refills out of a water drum instead of using water you're paying for and then to just flush it down the toilet. So anyway, that's just a side note. So another thing is streams, ponds, lakes. Those are all sources of water, but you got to be careful. For example, where I'm at, I live fairly close to the coast. So, that saying water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink is pretty serious around here, simply because a lot of our ditches are tidal, and we have brackish water. So you couldn't filter that water and have a good source of drinking water. There are some ponds close by that are not contaminated with salt water, and I've actually done some experiments with those, filtering and boiling and things of that nature, to see the viability of those as a potential water source in the event of a catastrophic situation. Unfortunately, water's heavy. I mean, I think it's 8 pounds per gallon, if I'm not mistaken. I probably am, but 8 pounds per gallon. That, man, 5 gallon bucket of water, that starts getting pretty heavy. And you imagine having to carry that if you don't have a vehicle or some way to move that without strapping it to your back. Man, you don't want to have to be doing that. So just bear in mind, you've got to be able to plan ahead. Another source is a well. Hand wells, a hand-dug shallow well, again, where I'm at, I can literally dig about 3.5, 4 feet. I think I'm going to say it's about 4 feet. And once you get past the clay layer, you hit sand. And I'm talking beach type sand. I mean, just regular old sand. And once you break through the last bit of the clay layer and you get into that, you water will just start seeping in. So I was digging a hole to put some posts in the ground, and I wanted to dig them fairly deep. I was going to try to go 5 feet, but as soon as I broke through that clay layer, man, and hit that sand, the water just started pouring in. So I was, all right, as far as I'm going, because I mean, I'm not digging a well. I was just digging a place to put in a post. So that's an option. If something does happen and the grid goes down, if you have a high water table, that is an option. I would still purify that water in some way, and I'll cover that shortly. The next thing is you've got deep wells, deep drilled wells. We have a well in our yard. It has it's a very deep, fairly deep well, and the pump is down in the well. And so if there's ever a situation the power's out, that well is almost useless, because it takes a lot of generator power to start that well. So I could probably I have a fairly sizable generator, so I would be able to start and run that. But again, we're on county water. The well is tied in, so we can turn a few valves and have some backflow prevention that we would be able to get water to the house if need be. But it's not really great water. So that's something that we could do, but it's, your options are limited for a long-term grid down situation. There are also what they call washdown wells, where you can go and buy a well point and basically just using water pressure, drive it down into the ground water table and be able to let that fill up with water. And you could use, I'm assuming you would probably use like again, that surface type pump with the old school pitcher pump. So again, there's an options there. In an urban environment, you've got rooftop water tanks that a lot of times, from what I understand, is that in larger cities, to be able to get pressure to a building, they'll have a huge water tank on the roof, and they let the gravity pressurize the system. So they'll have one main pipe running up to the roof from the municipality and going into this tank, and then it drains down and gives pressure to the apartment building or whatever. So there might be water tanks on roofs that you could get to. Water heaters are a fairly large vessel that holds, different amounts, varying sizes. And so that's a good source of clean, fresh water that you could, every water heater has a valve on the bottom that you can attach a water hose to drain the tank. And that's what it's meant for, is for draining the tank. So there's an option there that you would be able to, there's usually a pressure relief valve. And what you could do is hook a water hose, have it set so that you could collect it somehow, and then crack that valve or loosen the pipes on the top, and the water would just run right out. So that's an option. And people don't think about it, but the tank on the back of the toilet, unless you've put some sort of tidy bowl man blue thing or whatever in there, but for the most part, those tanks are clean water. So it might kind of not sound exactly right, but you could actually get some potable drinking water out of those. And if you're not comfortable with it, then you could you need to have some methods of water purification. And so that's what we're going to go into next, is water purification. So what are the methods of water purifying water? So I found an article at, of all places, Connecticut, and they had a list of four, and I've added a couple to those. Boiling water. Boiling water has probably been one of the main used methods of water purification for, you know, forever. Again, back in the day, they didn't understand parasites and people getting sick and all these diseases and stuff. But now we know better. So there's no excuse. So boiling water, it's pretty self-explanatory. It is labor-intensive, so you have to have some fairly large vessels if you're talking about, you know, more than one person. Again, 1 gallon of water per person per day. I mean, that's a lot of water. If you've got a family of four gallons of water just for hydration, just for, you know, drinking water. And if it's hot, there's no AC, the grid's down, you need to stay hydrated, because dehydration can kill you just as much as gunshot wound. Again, it's labor intensive. You got to have the equipment. You got to have a vessel large enough to be able to handle that water. And then you got to have the fuel to be able to boil and keep on a boil large amounts of water. So you only have to boil, theoretically, once you get the water hot enough to boil, it's basically killed everything. But if you put, once it gets to a rolling boil and you let it boil for about 1 to 3 minutes, especially here at sea level, you're in good shape. Now, boiling will only kill natural things, protozoa, giardia, things of that nature, viruses that are the things that make you sick. But again, you need to know your water source. If you're boiling water out of a runoff pond that, you know, had farm chemicals sprayed near it, that's something to be mindful of, because boiling will not get rid of chemicals or oil or anything of that nature. So just bear that in mind. The next, number two, was filtration. Now, filtration is probably by far the best method of cleaning water, because it takes out basically everything that you don't want in there. You have pre-filters that will filter out heavy debris. You have the, in many cases, they use a ceramic type filter. I use a MSR Hiker filter. It's a pump style, and it has three modes of filtration. One is a pre-filter that is basically just a little foam block at the end of the tube that you put in the water. That keeps the big heavy stuff out. You have a ceramic filter that is so tight and small that it won't allow these viruses and things of that nature to pass through it. I mean, it's still like 99.9 something percent. I mean, it's pretty high percentage. And then three, this one in particular that I have has a activated charcoal inside the ceramic filter. So that actually will remove ag chemicals and other heavy things such as oils and stuff like that. So again, you need to be mindful of where you're getting your water from and what's been around. Again, after a period of time, ag chemicals and oils and things of that nature will dissipate. They go away fairly quickly. So there's a lot of misinformation about chemicals and things of that nature. But as a licensed pesticide applicator in the state of North Carolina, you have to learn a lot of information about that. So that is beyond what we're talking about here. The next method is distillation. And distilling water is much like boiling the water. It's very labor intensive. You basically have to have a steel, like a moonshine steel, to be able to distill and collect water. I mean, you can do it without that, but it would be a lot more difficult. I mean, you could have some sort of system of tarps or pots and pans and things of that nature. You boil water into a plastic sheet, and the moisture would collect on the plastic sheet, and then you could have it run down into another vessel. I mean, it just would be, I could see it being very labor intensive and still prone to contamination, because your whole system would have to be clean. Additionally, from some of the reading and stuff that I've done, chemicals are not removed through distillation, because a lot of these chemicals are lighter than water. They will actually evaporate more quickly than water will, and so therefore they transfer over and are not removed. So just keep that in mind. The next one they had was chlorination, and chlorination is pretty much what it is. It says using chlorine bleach or some sort of chloride based tablets to break down and kill the bacteria. So for chlorine, I found on a website, modernsurvivalblog.com, and I'll put a link in my show notes. Bleach, water ratio for drinking water and purification. So basically, if you've got bleach, and this one is looking at the 8.25% sodium hypochlorite, which is regular bleach, for 1 quart of water, you need 1 drop or 1.3 drops of bleach. So a gallon, it says you need 5 drops. So that's pretty good. It does leave a fairly bad taste in the water. So having something like Gatorade or Mio or something of that nature to add to it would be a good thing to have. Tang, Kool-Aid, whatever. You're still going to get the hydrating effects. And having some sort of electrolyte replacement would not be a bad thing to have. So that's a good article over there. I would highly recommend you go and take a look at that. So there are some other methods of purification. Iodine, which is what we used in the military forever. And you want to talk about some of the worst taste in water you've ever, I mean, we've had to collect water out of creeks on Fort Benning, Georgia, and put iodine tablets in. And it's not something you want to do if you can avoid it. It is just pure nastiness. There's something called Aquatabs, and that basically oxygenates the water, from what I understand. And it unfortunately, that does not kill some of the cysts and viruses that will the cysts and viruses that will make you deathly ill. So there was I found an article over at the American Preppers Network. And if you go there or go to my site, and I'll have a link there, it's called What You Need to Know About Water Tablets. And it goes into some pretty good detail about the different types of water purification tablets that are available. The chlorine, the Aquatabs, for bacteria, it says it's highly effective. For viruses, somewhat effective. Most protozoa, somewhat effective. pH is an issue, 5.5 to 9. Cryptosporidium, it's not effective at all. And Giardia, it is effective. It takes 30 minutes to an hour to treat it with the aqua tabs. Iodine is the next choice, and it's highly effective on bacteria, viruses, somewhat effective on protozoa. You also have to worry about pH there, 5 to 9. Cryptosporidium is not effective, and Giardia is somewhat effective. And again, 30 minutes to an hour, you need to let the water sit. So the most effective one is chlorine dioxide, which for bacteria, virus, protozoa, it's highly effective. Any pH water, so pH is not a factor. Cryptosporidium is highly effective, and Giardia is highly effective. Now, the only thing about this, now they have listed here 30 minutes to 4 hours in this little chart, but in some of the other reading that I did, you need to be able to let the water stand or sit in the container for 4 hours before you drink it. 4 hours. That's key. You need to, if you want to be sure that if you are using those chlorine dioxide tablets, that you let it sit. So you need to plan ahead. Kind of keep an eye on your, you know, how much water you have and how much you're drinking, and be ready to resupply when necessary. So now, having said all that about water purification, I was listening to a podcast, and I don't recall who it was, but it was a survival, you know, they were talking about survival, this, that, and the other thing. And they weren't talking about, at the time, they weren't talking about a grid down situation. They were like, if you're lost in the woods or lost anywhere and you are without water, then just drink the water from a flowing water source. Don't, you know, of course, be smart. Don't drink stagnant, you know, stagnant water out of a dirty pond or something like that. But if you're only thinking that you're going to be out there for a couple of days, once you're rescued, they'll find you and they can treat you for any bugs that you get. It's not going to be nice, it's not going to be pretty, but it's better than dying of dehydration. So keep that in mind. And there are other survival methods of procuring water. Again, this is more, basically what I'm covering is more of the homestead or bugging in type thing. But if you're on the move and you need water, good thing to have in your kit is a clean sponge. And what you can do is early in the morning, if you're really hurting for water, early in the morning, especially here in the east, you know, south and east, is there's going to be dew collection all over the place. And you could take a sponge, and if you had vehicles around or flat surfaces, or I mean leaves, grass, whatever, you could wipe up that water and squeeze it into a vessel and then purify it. That's a method. Then you can also use a method of taking a trash bag and putting it over a bunch of leaves and limbs and stuff like that. And as the tree or whatever you're using aspirates out the moisture, it collects in this bag. And now I'm talking only, you're not going to get a lot. It's just a few drops, but sometimes that's all, you know, it's not necessarily going to keep you hydrated, but every little bit helps. So it's just another method of collecting water. So the next thing is we're going to talk about water storage options. So there are about a billion different ways to store water. So water bottles, having water bottles at home, currently, usually during the summer here, our local grocery store Food Line, they'll have cases, 24 count cases of water, the like 16.9 fluid ounce bottles. They have those by the case for $2 for $4 right now. Generally it's about $2 for $5. And so buying an extra couple of cases of water a week is not a big deal. I mean, you can build up a pretty good water storage and have a fairly portable source of water at any given time. Gallon jugs of water, as I mentioned previously, they are the milk jug type. Here at other stores, I guess it all depends on where you're at, they have the better, harder plastic, the kind of real clear plastic bottles. And those would be a lot better for long-term storage. Unfortunately, where I'm at, our only option is the milk jug type. And they are not great for long-term storage, as I mentioned previously about them breaking down over time. Again, I did mention water bricks. That's a great option if you want to spend the money. Like I say, I was just looking at, I did a search for it, came up with at brownells.com. They have water bricks. They're $15.99 a piece for 3.5 gallons of water. That's not the water included, but they hold 3.5 gallons of water. Or you can get an 8-pack for $122. And they stack real neat, man. And then 3.5 gallons, that'll carry you for, family of four for almost a day. There are options. And then they also have some different colored ones, that you can store, dry goods in. They have a spigot that, attaches to that. So you'd be able to do that. They also have a food brick, which would nest really well with the water bricks. So if you're limited on space and you want to be able to have something, I think that's a really good option. I wouldn't mind having a bunch. It would be a neat thing to have to be able to store. And you could mix your water bricks and your food bricks together and just have a good storage system. So the next thing is a collapsible water jug. I mean, we've all seen those things. You get them at Walmart or camping stores. I think they're, of course, they're sold under the Coleman name or whatever that the camping supply is. And they're maybe 5 gallon. We used them in the Scouts back in the day. But they're still available, and they have water containers at Walmart that you can buy. I think they're 5 gallon jugs, and those are options. Those are definitely things to have. Just a plain old 5 gallon water bucket. I found an article at Emergency Essentials website, or it's BePrepared.com, 5 myths about water storage. And that was a really good article that it would be worth taking a look at. And they go into the differences in the types of plastics that are safe for storing drinking water are ones with the number 1, number 2, and the number 4. And if you look on just about any plastic container, it'll have what looks like the recycle symbol with a number 1, 2, or 4. And like I'm looking right now at my Nalgene bottle, and I want to say it looks like a number 7, but I could be wrong. I might be mistaken on that. It's hard to see. It's kind of worn down. So you can also go out and buy these 265 gallon IBC totes. You can get them secondhand. A lot of times they are used for agricultural chemicals. You definitely do not want one of those for your drinking water system. If you're just building a cistern type system for like you flushing the toilet or whatever, then they would be fine for that. But you can also find ones that used food grade materials that have just been cleaned out and reused. Like here in North Carolina, we have Mount Olive Pickle. And, you know, they get, I guess they get brine or something, but if you go down around that area, they have those totes. You know, I think you can get them for $100-$150. And that's, man, that's a steal for a food grade container. You can also go to Tractor Supply or an Agri Supply or just about any ag supply store and buy black plastic tanks of various, you know, sizes, you know, up to 5,000 gallons if you wanted. And if you have a big enough budget, that might be an option. I've always wanted to take and have a old school windmill with a water tank built into it and have it just run right into my deep well and pump that tank full. And once it's over full, you can disengage the pump or you can just let it overflow into a pond or something like that. I mean, that would be a great option, you know, but you're talking like a $10,000 system. So, I mean, it's what's it worth to you to have the water, the ability to get the water? Some of the other things, another thing is having, for your personal Nalgene bottles, they're great. I love them. I carry three of them just about every day. I try to drink a gallon of water a day at minimum. Another option is, and a really good option is to get a single-walled stainless steel bottle about the size of a Nalgene. Dave Canterbury's site, he sells a real good system with the nesting cup and all that stuff. And Self-Reliance Outfitters, I believe. I'll look it up and I will put a link in the show notes. I have a system that I got about a year or so ago, and man, that thing, I've used it quite a bit in the field, boiling water and purifying it to have. And so having that option, I want to say Dave Canterbury in a video once said, you know, plastic bottles are stupid. I don't know. I can see his point of view, but for everyday use, the plastic bottles are great. You don't need to carry around a stainless steel bottle all the time, but having one is a good idea. So another thing that you can also do, and this goes back to the water procurement options, are if you do have a well, you may want to look at figuring out a way to maybe parallel your existing pump by putting in a 12 volt pump. They're available. They're relatively inexpensive compared to some of the other options out there, where you could have a couple 100 watt solar panels, a couple deep cycle batteries, and you could run a well pump off of 12 volt. It's going to be slow. You're not going to have a lot of pressure, but you can still it wouldn't take long to fill up a 5 gallon bucket. And I think you can go fairly deep with those. It's something I need to do a little bit more research on. Maybe I can do that in my gear closet. So another option is something called, I've run across it, it's called an earth straw. And basically, if you have a well, again, usually you'll have extra ports on the top of the well cap, and you take out one of those ports and you basically thread down a piece of plastic hose down into the well pump or into the well casing, and you'll have basically a big siphon up on the surface that you just pull it up and push it back down, pull it up, push it back down. And basically it turns it into an old school, almost like a pitcher pump type setup. Those can be relatively expensive for what they are. And there are probably some DIY systems that are available. It's something I really need to look into. So, again, this is nothing comprehensive. This is not the end all be all. This is not everything that is out there. It's just to get you thinking about what you might need to do. Do your own research. Everybody's different. Every place is different. Everybody's needs are different. A family of eight is going to have more water need than a family of four or an individual. So it's something to keep in mind. So I'm going to wrap the water part up about that. If there are any questions or comments, please, please, please go to the Facebook page, Facebook group, or go to my website and send me a comment, send me a link. You can always send me an email at thedopefarmpodcast@protonmail.com or wparkinson4@protonmail.com is also another good option. I'd love to have the interaction on the website. Please consider Patreon. Oh, wait a minute. I'm about to forget the Gear Whore Gear Closet. I'm going to start talking about the ankle medical holsters that I'm going to be reviewing. I'm starting out with the Rescue Essentials Ankle Medical Holster. And the reason why I'm doing that is they were the first ones to actually provide me one for test and evaluation. I will probably go into much more detail later once I get a more comprehensive testing done with more of the different holsters that I get. This will be, I'm pretty much decided I'm going to do this in an installment type situation, and then I'll do probably a whole podcast culminating at the end once I figure out how many I'm actually going to have to test. I will say that Rescue Essentials, I reached out to them and they did provide me for free one of their medical holsters. So I just full disclosure there. I have a couple of more that I have purchased. And so, you know, I want to be fully open and honest, and I don't want, you know, I don't have any favoritism to one or the other. The ones that I have purchased, I did get a discount. So, anyhow, the Rescue Essential ones, what I'm carrying in it is a package of hemostatic gauze, several pairs of nitrile gloves, an H&H mini compression bandage, a pair of Hyphen chest seals, and a Gen 4 soft T wide tourniquet. And I'm basically all the ankle kits that I test are, I'm going to use the same stuff. So that way I get a across the board thing. So looking at the Rescue Essentials website, the Rescue Essentials ankle medical holster retails for $25.95. Let's see its description. It says the newly upgraded ankle medical holster is a medical kit designed to be worn around the user's ankle. Lightweight and comfortable, it can be worn as part of your everyday carry, whether you are civilian, law enforcement, or military. Upgrades include rounded corners, 2x3 PALS panel, red pull tab, padding for comfort, and an improved fit. Designed to fit a CAT or the Soft TY Gen 3 tourniquet, 4-inch Israeli emergency bandage, 2 pairs of gloves. It can accommodate a SWAT T needle decompression kit, and other items. A stocked version is available as well. Features: elastic storage bands and pouches. Customizable to the user's preference. Lightweight and comfortable. The main pouch has a red tab for instant identification and three pockets plus a 2x3 PALS ladder. The dimensions are 5.25 high, 19 inches wide. The dimensions intended to fit circumference from 9 to 16 inches. Its weight empty is 4 ounces. So I've been carrying this thing. I got it on a Monday. Can't exactly think of the date, but I got it on a Monday. I want to say Monday the 10th of June 2019. And went ahead and stocked it up and put it on my ankle. I've worn it every day since I got it. And honestly, I was kind of concerned. I wasn't sure how it would wear, but it actually wears very well. I will say that the Rescue Essentials Ankle Medical Holster is very well made. It's very comfortable to wear. It will take the soft T-wide tourniquet with no problem. They can be folded fairly flat. And it holds in the main pouch with the lid, the flap. It holds all three of the different items: the chest seal, the compression bandage, and the gauze, the hemostatic gauze. It'll hold all that with no problem. I wear with the pouch inboard. I've seen most people wear it with the pouch outboard. I do that because working on the farm, you're crawling around a lot. You might be on the ground, and when that part hits the ground, it's kind of uncomfortable. So I run it inboard on the inside of my ankle, and it works fairly well. I haven't had any issues with it scrubbing my other leg. For everyday wear, it's very comfortable. You basically forget that it's even there. The only complaint that I have is that it's not made in America. It is made in China, but the quality seems very well done. I would recommend it to anyone. For $25, it's a very affordable option for compared to some of the others out there that I'll discuss later. I've got multiple pairs of nitrile gloves stuffed in. There's a third little pocket there, and I have, I think, 3 or 4 pairs of nitrile gloves stuffed in there. So it's very comfortable. I'm not sure what I would do with the PALS webbing. I'm going to try to reach out to the gentleman that provided it to me from Rescue Essentials. I'm not really sure what the PALS webbing's for, what you would do with that. So maybe they can shed some light on that. Rescue Essentials is a company here in North Carolina. I think they used to be somewhere else, but now they're based in Leland, North Carolina, just south of Wilmington. If you need medical supplies, go check them out. They have really decent prices on a lot of their kit. I'd say they're on par with most of the other medical retailers that I've seen out there. I think they're a fairly small business. So, like I say, they were very gracious in providing me one of their ankle holsters, and I really appreciate that. And I want to give a shout out to Bill from Rescue Essentials for providing that to me. And I'll probably give a little bit more detailed, in-depth review later on, but I just wanted to touch on that. And I'm going to go to another one next, probably next week. I'm going to try to wear them a week at a time, just because right now I've got 4 that I've got to look at. And I know that I have at least 1, possibly 2 more on the way. So this could turn into a very long, drawn out thing. So, I didn't really intend to be that way. I'd rather wear it for like a month, but just from my initial impression of wearing it for a week, I would highly recommend. I could definitely put my stamp of approval on this. If the Berry compliant is an issue for you because it's made in China, that, you know, that's just what it is. It is what it is. So having said that, man, this is going to be probably the longest podcast I've done yet. I want to say thank you all for listening. Come out, check out my website, thedopefarmpodcast.com. Come by the Facebook page, join the Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and search The Dope Farm Podcast and it'll pop up. And I have a link to the group on the Facebook page. Please come by, join the group. Let me know what you think, criticism, whatever you got. Give it to me. I'm a big boy. I can handle it. Patreon. I'm up to 2 patrons now. And I want to thank both of you guys for helping me out. That now basically covers my bandwidth for posting this. So anybody that, if you think there's any value in this website or see that there is potential here, please consider going to Patreon, The Dope Farm Podcast, becoming a patron. I have 2 tiers, a $2 tier and a $5 tier. So please, just whatever, if you feel like you can, if you can become a patron, I'd really appreciate that. So I'm going to close it out with my usual, and I want to say God bless you and God bless America. And don't forget, go to, if you have a problem, if you have an issue, going back to the end of the previous show when I talked about suicide prevention. If you feel bad, if you feel that you need to take your life or someone else's life for that matter, man, reach out. Reach out to somebody. Talk to somebody. Just because they don't call you on a regular basis, reach out. Call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Call 1-800-273-8255. They're available every day, 24 hours a day. Get help. Reach out. God bless you. God bless America.